Hello and welcome to episode 24 of the Complimentary Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Langerman, joined as always by Anthony Hobday. And for this last episode of the year, we're going to be doing something kind of fun today and sharing some hot takes. Well, Anthony will be sharing some hot takes and I will be responding to them and giving my my feedback on them.
Yeah, you haven't seen them.
No.
And well, it makes sense that they are hot takes because I wrote them down without thinking about them much. And so I haven't really thought about them, even though I obviously have seen them and wrote them down. These could be, like all hot takes, awful. But I'm not sure how capable I am of writing down something that's truly awful without really, you know, considering it. So hopefully there's some nugget of truth in every single one of them. Mm-hmm. When you said episode 24, I thought, wow, if we'd been doing one episode every 2 months, we'd have been doing this for a year, 2 years. And I realized how silly that was as a concept. I just realized that 24 was, you know, 12 times two. And I thought, yeah, wow, that's a long time, but actually it's not that long.
Well, we skipped a couple months this year and we started in February. So we're not at our 1 year yet, but we will be soon.
Yeah, close.
We're getting close there. For hot takes, well, first I applaud you for sharing them because my hot takes are internal. For internal use only. I don't like to share them publicly. Usually, you don't, I don't know. And I think you said you also tend to not share your hot takes on Twitter like a lot of people do.
Oh, never.
Yeah. Why is that for you?
It's more permanent. It feels like, even though this has been recorded, it feels like because it's a conversation, it's less permanent. Also, I can give a lot of disclaimers here that a post on a social media network is maybe less suited for. So, as a disclaimer, I don't necessarily agree with all the things I'm about to say.
Okay.
Like I say, I haven't thought about them for long. And so I'm very happy to be proven wrong. These are not beliefs I hold strongly.
Mm. Okay.
They're more like ideas I'm testing on you.
Oh, no.
I didn't write all of them to try to rile you up. I think some of them, especially the first one, is there to challenge you personally.
Okay.
But the rest of them, I think maybe you might agree with more just because they are quite common complaints people have about the design community or that sort of thing.
I guess the first one's about design systems then.
I mean, that's, you know, who could tell?
Who could tell? Okay, cool.
Do you want me to just jump in?
You want to? Yeah, let's just jump in. How many do you have, by the way?
Oh, let's see. I've got seven.
Okay.
I carried on writing them down. It might be that each one of these could be a full, you know, podcast episode. So I'm going to go rapid fire, relatively rapid fire. And I'm not expecting you to try to prove or disprove my theory in the episode. Feel free to be light touch.
Okay.
Especially if it really riles you up, because you know, otherwise we might spend the whole half an hour on the first one.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
Okay, you ready?
I'm ready.
Most software companies don't need and can't manage a design system.
Classic hot take.
Yeah.
Am I responding to this one or are you going to keep going through all?
Well, no, yeah, I was going to do one at a time and I can try to back it up with a bit more explanation if you like, but you might want to respond immediately. It's up to you.
No, give me some, where is this coming from?
Yeah, partly this is because it seems like design system as a term has come to mean something quite formal and large and therefore hard to manage. And I think if you take design system to mean something a lot more general and basic, you know, for example, just the primitives or whatever they're called, just the design tokens, like here are the three colors we use and here is the text sizes we use, and that's a design system. Then I think this hot take becomes a lot less hot because actually it's much easier for a company with only one designer to manage just the typography that they use, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, these are the typefaces we use. These are the sizes. That's it. Everything else is up for grabs. Maybe here's a, you know, accent color. But if a design system is what most people seem to be talking about, which I think is probably because that's what most people get paid for and make money from, and, you know, there's a lot more to talk about when it's a big design system with fully defined components, all that stuff. I found again and again in smaller companies that it's just, you can do a 6-month project where you set up the design system, but it ends up essentially not being worth it because it immediately gets out of date and it's at least half of your job just to maintain the thing. Whereas you could be spending half of that job, you know, designing things that use that design mm-hmm. system. So it feels like design systems are unnecessary for the long tail of software companies.
Yeah. When you say, are you talking on the design end? Like when you say you work on this thing for 6 months, do you mean just like a Figma design system or code?
Yeah, I'm thinking of projects I've been in where we set up a design system in the first place, defined it all, made it sure it was all consistent. And then, it ends up that we basically don't implement all of that. It just sits there as an ideal state and the code lags behind by 2 years. Which also makes it feel pointless.
Yeah.
Because ideally they'd match up as close as possible, as soon as possible, and then maintenance is much easier.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of agree with you to some extent, depending on like what we mean by design system, but like especially if you don't have any code connection to it, then I think it's a waste of time to be like building out this dream state of how you want things to look in Figma and then not implement it. It will just rot and not really get anywhere. And then on the code side, I think starting with a style guide is like sufficient. I kind of miss those days of like when I say style guide, I mean when we used to use SAS and you'd have like a style sheet just called variables and you would just define all your colors and it would be like really simple. You could like maybe darken or lighten them if you wanted to do something fun. And it was just like simple days of just having like a variable sheet. It just gets more complicated when you want to share components. That's where it's like, okay, well, if several teams, I mean, I guess this is if we're talking about a small company, maybe it's just one team, but if individuals are building the same component over and over again, slightly differently each time, then it's like, okay, maybe it's time to systematize this. But I don't think a small company needs to hire externally and bring in like a design system expert and like build the whole thing and then start shipping stuff. Like you should be focusing on shipping stuff first and then the design system will work itself out. So yeah, maybe not that hot of a take.
No, I think that helps me realize that it maybe what I have a problem with is design system as a starting point. It seems like design systems are almost always better as a response.
I think so too. Yeah, I totally think that's true.
Okay, so
warm take.
Katie Langerman, design systems unnecessary. 2023. Someone note it down.
Don't
full agreement. Put it on the record.
Yeah.
Okay. Next hot take. This is probably not a surprise to anyone who knows me or has seen anything I've ever written. Quality, including beauty, are good for their own sake, and all humans should aim for them, even if they lead to commercial problems.
What do you mean by commercial problems?
To be clear, because that's the most sort of controversial bit probably, I don't mean even if a company's going under, they should still be like pumping out the highest quality stuff they can.
Yeah.
I mean, even if it doesn't help you to reach your target or makes it harder to reach your target commercially. Like, oh, ideally we'd have as much profit as possible. But actually, because we're focusing on quality, beauty, performance, those sorts of nice-to-haves, maybe we're making half as much profit as we'd like to. I still think that those things are good for their own sake. I don't think they should ever be subservient to commercial goals, unless your commercial goals are basically there to help you survive, to stay afloat. Then it's a different balancing act. But I think the world needs to be higher quality. The world needs to be more beautiful. The world needs to perform better. And that should apply to software. We should be sacrificing things to achieve those. Although, separate hot take, we shouldn't be sacrificing our work-life balance. That seems to be the thing that, you know, people are willing to sacrifice their workers', you know, health. They're not necessarily willing to sacrifice their commercial performance, which feels like the wrong way around.
That's tricky. Yeah, I mean, I've been there. Like, you care so much about the quality in a company maybe that doesn't care about it. And so you're like, that's okay. I'll just use my own time to make sure that it's quality and work on the weekend sometimes because I'm so passionate about it. And it's like, where, I mean, great, you're passionate about quality, That's really great. But what is the company, like, what is this doing for you personally? Is the company giving you anything for this? No. So I don't know how you justify it, though. Like, how do you speak to a business, a businessy person and say, yeah, we got to sacrifice making money for quality?
This is the annoying thing, is that you can't justify quality or beauty, those sorts of things, to people, because they are already pre-justified. Like, everyone understands the value of quality and beauty and performance. Mm-hmm. And so I think it comes down to, like you say, giving up whatever it is that you would have to give up to achieve those things. And I don't think people should work weekends. I think the company should just ship less stuff. Like, that's the opposite way. Like, you're releasing less features, or you're responding to requests slower because you're taking more time on them.
Yep.
And so I don't think you can justify it. I think you have to find someone who it's already justified for. Like, it's much more important than some other things that they'd have to sacrifice instead.
Mm. Someone at the top of the chain that agrees with you. How long will you stay in a role where that is not the case and you're constantly fighting for it? Like, is it worth it to be doing that? Or should you just continue looking for a company that just does agree with that principle?
Yeah, I think it's sort of, there's a nice echo or reflection there, in the sense that if you approach it the right way, I think if you work for a company where they don't value quality and they value the commercial goals instead, then it's perfectly natural and right for you as an employee to value commercial goals as well, and therefore just be there for the money. So if the leaders aren't going to value quality, then I'm also not going to value quality, and I'm just going to get paid every day.
Yeah.
Or every week or every month or whatever. And so I don't think it's a bad thing if an employee steps back from caring about that because the company is not willing to care about it. That maybe ironically feels natural to me, that you would match what the company cares about. And so I do think it has to start at the top. And I don't think people should punish themselves to make up for the lack of quality.
Yeah.
In the company culture.
I agree with that. There's a lot of privilege sometimes in this conversation where people will advocate for, like, standing up for something or leaving the company entirely. It's like, that's just not an option for everybody. Some people have to financially stick around for reasons, or they need a promotion for reasons. And so, yeah, that's like a touchy subject. I think that it's better to approach it with, I don't know, a bit more curiosity and grace, I guess, for people in that position.
Hmm. Next one?
Next one. Let's go.
Animation is the most overused web design thing. I've always thought that animation should be basically the sprinkles on top.
Yeah.
Like, it should come at the end. And especially more recently, especially with marketing websites, animation has become more of a focus. I think it should be less of a focus. And part of the reason I believe this is because I keep seeing websites where they are relying on the animation work they've done, which is impressive, and they are not spending enough time on the more foundational aspects of good design, like performance. I see some websites that have got an impressive animation, but on a powerful computer, the animation is like stuttering.
Yeah.
And so clearly they care more about the fact that the animation is there and that it's sort of conceptually impressive than they do about making sure that the website performs well across the board.
Mm-hmm.
But also simple things like layout and using the space well, like sort of use of white space. Also things like, you know, typography, visual hierarchy. Some of those things are getting sacrificed for animation. And in my mind, animation should basically be the thing that you focus on once everything else is done well.
Right.
And so it feels, in almost every case, overused because it's the last step to me.
Do you miss animation if it's not there? Like, what if a site has basically zero animation?
This happened with the new Vercel website, because someone pointed out that when it was released, that it didn't have much animation and therefore felt a bit not modern.
Oh.
Like, they said it didn't feel like a well-designed website by modern standards, and that's because so many of the websites that get called out are ones that have lots of animation and, like, you know, little Easter eggs and things when you hover over containers and whatnot.
Yep.
And it feels like completely the wrong way around because, I mean, they recently wrote an article, the people who worked on the website, where they talk through all of the decisions they made. And they put so much thought into everything foundational about the website and then left out a lot of that sort of focus on animation, even though they do have thoughtful use of animation throughout the website. And they also cover that aspect. So it's an interesting case study of, in my mind, this is them focusing on the right things and then leaving out the thing that comes at the end. And in other cases, someone focuses on the thing that comes at the end and sort of puts less focus on what I think of as the right things, which is the most foundational sort of things. Like, they put so much thought into grid-based layout and stuff, and that's the sort of thing that a lot of people don't do, which that feels like the wrong way around to me.
That's interesting. I guess that really depends on the audience here, and also the medium is, like you said, it was a landing page. I actually am not familiar with this new landing page design, but, you know, I think people are looking for flashy kinds of things when they want to go see the new landing page for XYZ company versus when you think about product design. This is exactly what we talked about. Application style last episode, like, then you are much more fine-tuned. You're much more focused on the details of layout and typography and user experience, maybe. But
yeah,
I don't know. That's interesting. I think that is kind of a hot take. I see animation as like one of those pieces of the puzzle that can feel very disconnected from the rest of the experience because it is sort of disconnected. Like, it should be more integrated, but it's usually not really a huge part of like a design system, for example. And so you do have a lot of flexibility to just go in and sprinkle all your little animations in. And it's like, what was the purpose of these decisions? And how is it connected to everything? And so it can end up feeling really disconnected. So I guess I think that's a personal preference.
And I think it's partly because it's related to the purpose of the website, the sort of the underlying concept. And so in the article about the Vercel website, they talk about how it's a framework you use to build the web, basically. And so that informed a lot of their visual design decisions. It has this sort of blueprinty feel and this grid effect. You're seeing the underlying sort of structure. And so that makes perfect sense. And the one time that I really appreciate a heavy focus on animation is when the product that the website promotes is an animation library.
Oh, yeah.
Because in that case, there's such a clear link to what the product is, and they're demonstrating how capable it is because they're using their own library to show the animations. That fits so much, and to build a website like that around the concept of animation makes perfect sense to me. But when you're selling, you know, banking software and you're using heavy animation, it's like, is my money going to be flying around when I'm checking my balance? Probably not. Like, do you need animation to tell me this story? Or are you just doing it so that the design community will be impressed by it and share the website? And so animation as a marketing method feels like it's taking focus away from the right thing and putting it on the wrong thing. But if you have an animation library, it all goes out the window. And so the animation, website animation I like the most historically has been for animation libraries.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, lines up.
Yes. They're usually the best because they know what they're doing.
Yeah. Oh, also, well, I was about to say agency websites tend to use a lot of animation.
Yeah.
That's because they're demonstrating their skill set. But then I have a problem with the fact that they're demonstrating animation as like a primary thing that they offer because they shouldn't be using it for most of their websites they build for people, in my opinion. So maybe they should focus on animation less as well.
Yeah. I agree with you.
But I don't want to annoy the agency people. They're a bit cutthroat. So we can edit that out. Next one.
Yes.
Job titles are next to useless and definitely not worthy of conversations between designers at different companies.
Okay. Explain the last part a little bit more.
So I, when I was writing this, I was thinking actually job titles are useful to talk about within your company.
Yes.
This is your job title. This is my job title. We work together. What does
how
that
much
mean
do you
about
make?
How we relate? Partly, yeah. It's definitely related. And so there, the job titles help to explain how you relate to each other. That can be a useful thing to discuss because maybe you want to represent the system that you're all working within through the language that you use to describe a system, right? That seems like a reasonable concept to me. But when you've got different companies and people at different companies talking to each other, the job title that I have is naturally going to be different to the job title that you have, probably, because you work at a much larger company. There's a much more systematic approach to how people are employed, how they work together. I'm the only designer at my company, and so it really doesn't matter what I'm called. I could choose anything, and I think my managers or the people who own the company wouldn't really care what I was called.
Right.
And so because I could choose anything as my job title and it wouldn't really matter, what's the benefit of having a conversation about my job title with someone else, a different company, about their title and trying to compare those two? You know, I might be called a product designer and so might somebody else be called that. But if my company has no other design roles and their company has 18 other design roles, all of which are slightly different, suddenly what a product designer is matters more.
Yeah.
But I see a lot of these conversations where actually they're not comparing their contexts before they're talking about the titles. And that seems pointless.
Yes, I agree with that. I mean, you can't just be like, well, I'm senior or whatever, and that, or people who are like, I really want to get to senior. What does that mean at your company compared to other companies? So you have to have a lot of context to be able to discuss it for a good reason outside of your own company. But it does still matter what it is outside of your company, because you won't work inside your company forever. And so it can, I guess, impact hiring or like getting a job somewhere else if you don't show a promotion potentially, or like show growth from whatever senior to staff on your LinkedIn profile. And then you're applying for a staff level. And see, I'm already using words that probably mean nothing to your company. But if they don't see that you already have one of those, like it might be harder to get that interview. But for you, like if you had the same job title for 4 years, even though you were technically getting paid more, or like you technically got a promotion, but your title didn't change at all, like that might be hard to market yourself outside of your company. Maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, this is definitely a small company hot take. When I became a designer, and 6 months later I was made a designer full time, essentially they made it more official and they said choose your own title, and I chose head of design as the only designer at the company, and they accepted that immediately. There was no question of
that's your title.
No, this was at the first company I ever worked at.
Okay,
so I was most definitely a junior designer.
That's
insane.
I was
head of design within 6 months, so that's why it feels like they, you know, aren't as important as they seem.
Yeah, because if someone saw, I would see that on your LinkedIn and be like, okay, there is judgment from people who say they are head of design, or what's another? I don't know. I guess that is kind of the main one, that have been at a company for like very little time and they don't have a lot of experience before that. You're just like, yeah, okay, you're head of design. Yeah. What does that mean? But
I think even if you, regardless of the company you work at, the title only matters to the extent that someone who gets contacted for a reference will agree or disagree with it.
Yeah.
Because I could be called head of design at a company for, you know, 5 years, but then if I go and apply for a different job, I could call myself product designer. And if they get in touch with that company and say, was he a product designer? If my company still says yes, even though that wasn't my technical title, then it doesn't matter what I was called the entire time I was working there, because I get to choose essentially. And so if you got up to a staff designer level at GitHub and then left and called yourself senior product designer, I'm curious whether or not GitHub, someone in HR would be like, no, that was not their title. Like whether
I have no idea.
Push the issue. Because if they're not going to, then again, the titles aren't that important, because you're sort of judging what the equivalent is, and it's only up to them to agree or disagree.
Maybe if you have the opportunity to pick your own title, you should pick things that you think will help you get your next role that seem relevant. So
Chief
you're not
creative officer.
Because if you call yourself head of design and then you're applying for senior product designer, I think that would throw people off. They'd be like, well, why do you want to be a IC all of a sudden? You used to be the head of design.
I really want to get back to basics, you know, and find myself again. I'm tired of being the most expert person in the room, etc.
Yep. Okay, I like that one.
Yeah, next one.
Yep.
Designers can be too optimistic in the sense that we believe that any problem can be solved well with enough time and effort.
Ooh.
I was writing about this recently, actually, on social media.
designers can be too optimistic. And so in this scenario, they're like saying, I mean, this is kind of like one of your other hot takes, but if we just have more time and we push less features, then we can achieve this high bar of quality.
It's along the lines of, I think designers can naturally assume that given a hypothetical problem of which they don't know the details yet, that just with the magic of design, they can come up with an ideal solution.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's that assumption that some designers seem to have, including myself in past years, seems to be completely at odds with all of our experience as designers, which is no solution is ever perfect. There's always trade-offs.
Yeah.
And so I find those two things don't match up, and actually maybe it's helpful to be a bit more cynical, a bit more practical upfront, and say, I'll do my best to find something that works for everyone. But I'm not going to present myself as being able to find a perfect solution before I've dived into this problem.
Yeah. That's really
maybe
tricky.
Maybe one of those things is about promoting yourself and sort of making sure that it seems like you're the right person for the job. And maybe one of them is about actually doing the work. And maybe those two things have different purposes and different sort of directions and goals. Maybe the people who hire you want to hear nothing but positivity about solving a problem, but they're also happy to hear 2 months later, oh, we've had to pull things back a lot because we've realized that this problem and this problem and this problem. So maybe it's fine to be eternally optimistic before you've heard any details, but that feels like a strange thing to do, especially when all of our experience is much more pessimistic.
Yeah. I'm wondering if this is if it's just different in design system land, because I'm feeling like sometimes you get praised actually for not, what's the best way to say this? Like, obviously you don't want to start the project from a negative lens and just be like, whatever, I'm just going to do it. This is good enough. This is fine. I think that's dangerous if you get into the habit of just good enough work. Like, it starts to show, people notice, people lose trust in you. It doesn't feel as good. But if you also, on the flip side, become the person that's constantly pushing and pushing and pushing and really trying to extend things, and like nothing is good enough, and you're kind of complaining a lot but not giving a lot of solutions, also not very fun to work with. So you have to find the happy medium of like being optimistic up front, but not too optimistic, being realistic and saying like, we can cover this amount of cases with this, but maybe not everything. And we'll try to help those people with those edge cases that we can't cover, but like we will just be spinning in circles if we try to cover everything. And I think leadership would actually appreciate that perspective more, at least on the design system side, where they're like, yes, this is good enough, but still quality. And then we can move forward and finish this thing and move on to the next, versus like dragging it on and on and on and never actually shipping anything and never finishing anything. And then there's a lot of frustration. So got to find that sweet spot. I think it just takes a lot of experience to figure out what it is for you personally.
Yeah, there's a concept here that I think I learned from Basecamp, 37 Signals. And regardless of how people feel about 37 Signals and Basecamp, they have explored a lot of interesting ideas about how to build software and how they approach it, their whole philosophy. And one of them is one that they've sort of codified in their application Basecamp. It's called Hill Charts, which you might have seen.
Not familiar with it.
So Hill Charts is something that I think they did, and I don't think anyone else has done since. But basically, it's this concept where if you imagine a hill on a piece of paper, it's like a bell curve almost. You're using it as a way to mark your progress through a project. And so until you've reached the top of the hill, you don't understand everything about the problem. Oh. And that's the sort of halfway point. And after that, it becomes a lot easier. So that effort level goes down. You start going down the hill. So it becomes a lot easier. And it's more about implementation. But that initial uphill section is about understanding. And what I like about that is that it feels like as designers, we often present ourselves or are seen as solution finders. Like, we will solve a problem. And that feels a bit too optimistic. Because often you understand the problem and you realize there is no solution, or the solution is not going to be good. And so it feels like maybe as designers, we should be positioned more as problem understanders. And there's definitely lots of things that point in that direction, right? We are there to understand a problem. but we're not going to know whether we can solve the problem or how well we can solve it until we understand it. And so I think researchers are much better at sort of being positioned in this way. Researchers like, no, we go in, we understand the problem, and we share that understanding with people. We're not necessarily there to solve it. I think all designers should be seen that way to a certain extent, where we are the people you call in if you want someone to understand the shape of a problem. And then the solution will suggest itself, or we'll come up with lots of different solutions, but we're not being sent in from the start to solve something, because that feels a bit too positive.
It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. And so maybe we shouldn't be using that sort of language. I think often we talk about solving problems when actually we should be talking about understanding problems.
Yeah, totally agree.
Because it could be that you understand a problem and then decide to do nothing, in which case you've not solved it at all.
That's often stressful, but also sometimes a relief when you come to the conclusion that, like, okay, we aren't going to solve for these things, just these. It's like, oh,
yeah,
I can actually move forward now versus designer spinning. Their head is spinning and they're just like, nothing is going to work. I can't solve all the problems. This is it's a lost cause. And then you lose your mind. You got to be careful of that.
Yeah. Every step of the design process seems to be about facing practical reality apart from before we start the project, in which case we're like, yeah, we're going to solve the problems.
Yeah. Okay.
So next one. I've got two more.
Okay.
And, we're already over time.
Yeah.
So I'll try and run through them.
Speedy.
I think you'll agree with this one, though, because we've definitely discussed it before, but I've taken it to an extreme. Better leadership is almost always a solution to design problems. And I will qualify that by saying that I think this is sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because when leadership is not the solution to a problem, we generally care enough to fix the problem ourselves. So it's basically all the problems that are left over that we can't fix ourselves. Leadership has to be the solution. I've seen this so many times by talking to so many people that basically leadership is the problem. And that feels like a hot take, because it seems like a lot of sort of public takes don't get out there about this, because the leadership has obviously got oversight over what is made public.
Can't say that. It's not safe to say these things. We can speak generically about it. I'm not speaking about my company specifically when I talk about this, I guess, but obviously I'm drawing from my personal experiences. So it's just really hard to talk about it. But I feel empathy for design leadership, because what a weird position to be in. I guess it's like being the president of the country. I don't know. You get blamed for everything. You have very little insight into what's actually happening, and like, is that your fault, or is that because of the position you're in? How are you supposed to have insight into what's happening because you're not an IC? So
the higher up you get, the more things are pulling you in different directions, right? The more priorities you have to manage. And so of course designers are going to think that leadership should be replaced with someone who cares most about design, but then you end up building an app that is commercially a failure, even though it's absolutely beautiful or really high quality or very performant. And you know, did it matter that you had a leadership that cared a lot about design? Because, you know, there's no company anymore.
Right.
So I can see that. It's just selfishly, as a designer, leadership is the problem.
Yeah, that's a struggle for me. I'm trying to understand it more myself lately. But because people also change, you could get a leader who cares a lot about design, and then the longer they're in that leadership position, the less they care about it because of reasons that you aren't privy to. And it's not that they're a bad person. That's the position that they've been put in. So,
yeah. And it's a shame that the designer in that position doesn't see those changes. They might experience it, but they're not seeing the cause, you know.
Transparency.
Nor should they necessarily, because like, not every employee should be aware of every change that's happening at the executive level, for example. That feels a bit inefficient. But, you know, if there was a way for leadership to basically update you once a quarter and say, oh, we're feeling a lot more pressure in this area, just so your expectations are set a bit more when suddenly they say, we're going to put less money into design, or we're going to ship things faster. Maybe that would soften the blow.
Yeah. I don't know if there's any winning in this scenario, but it's fun to think about it and explore more.
It's all trade-offs.
Yeah.
Okay, one more.
Last one.
Some websites are good showcases, but hard to use or understand, and I think it's wrong. This feels like the animation topic again.
Yeah.
But basically, I came across this recently because I read something by someone who talked about showcases as a word, and I quite like that idea, as some designers build things to show something off.
Yeah.
And that thing they're showing off is not necessarily the reason that the website was built or the purpose it's trying to achieve. Just like the animation we were talking about. And often that frustrates me because it seems like the best design I ever come across is the stuff that supports the purpose, like 100%. Yeah. And all stems from that. And actually, well, like the agency websites I was talking about, often that website is a showcase of the agency's abilities and not necessarily a showcase of the agency's sort of commercial success or their ability to find commercial success for their clients. I think the agency is there to build you something that will help you achieve your goals. And actually, the agency is showcasing their technical ability in a way that will help them to get more business. So they're really trying to further their own goals rather than trying to further their clients' goals with the website they have designed. So there's a few layers there, but yeah, showcase design is a good term for it. And I realized I don't like it.
I mean, I think the same agency design is similar to portfolio design sometimes, because you're showcasing work you've done for other, like lots of different brands potentially. So what is it that your website is supposed to be saying or doing? I guess it's supposed to be showing your own personal skills. It's just tricky sometimes to blend those two things, to show like the portfolio and the case studies and your own personal point of view. I don't know where I'm going with this, but you just kind of made me think, I guess it is kind of like a showcase. But I'm trying to think of an example of a website that is supposed to be functional, but then looks like a showy showcase. Have you experienced that?
Yeah, it's hard to think of examples apart from agency websites on the spot.
Yeah.
Because I think your point about like personal portfolio is an interesting one, because that's a showcase in a slightly different way in that. I mean, yeah, the website mainly exists to showcase your skills. There's not so much focus for a portfolio, for example, for someone to convert in the sense that they click on the contact me button, for example, usually because they send the portfolio URL to someone. And so the person already knows what the next step is. They don't have to be led to a bright red button that they click and then, you know, everyone's happy. Whereas an agency, now that I think about it, I don't actually know whether agencies are trying to convert people. Maybe they are also basically sending the equivalent of a CV and a link. And doing cold outreach, and maybe they don't care if someone converts because they are just trying to showcase. So there's a fair chance I've misunderstood the purpose of an agency website. But, I mean, the one that really gets me, for example, is if someone builds a personal portfolio and they use like a 3D library, and they basically turn, and this is quite rare because it's very hard to do, but they turn their website into basically like an interactive world that you can walk through. And so sort of, the aim they're apparently trying to reach is that you read more about them and learn more about them and get in touch with them. But they've made those things extremely hard because you're being distracted by a car driving around a city.
Right.
Or whatever. Yeah, and so that car driving around the city has nothing to do with the person, but it does have to do with their skills.
Yeah.
And it annoys me when the apparent purpose is like so far away from the real purpose.
Yeah. I know we've talked about that before, because it depends on what you're trying to get from. If you're landing on someone's personal website, are you just quickly trying to understand something about them, who they are, like where they work or something? Or are you trying to experience the showcase that they have? Because there are some websites that are really intended to be like an experience, but maybe don't combine that with your personal site. Maybe that is like a secondary site that you've created to have this fun experience so that you can still have this like more simple show, this more simple, I don't know. Showcase. Now I'm just gonna keep using that word of like who you are and what you're all about. But
yeah, and that's everything.
Okay, you know, these weren't as spicy as I thought they might be. Actually, I didn't think they would be spicy, but I was kind of like thinking that they could be potentially.
It's hard for me to be too spicy because I'm hopefully I'm a reasonable person, and
you are.
I think the sorts of hot takes that really. I mean, it also helps that I'm able to sort of qualify everything I say in the moment because it's a podcast.
Yeah. I don't know that there's a lot of value in super spicy takes other than to generate a lot of people to comment angrily on Twitter threads. So I think it's better to have kind of more well thought out, more well-rounded takes and be willing to be proven wrong. But I didn't really prove you wrong at all today because I pretty much agreed with everything that you said.
Well, if you're listening at home, send us an angry comment on social media if you thought the takes were too spicy.
Oh, yeah. Send us your own hot takes. Create your own Twitter thread hot takes just to spite us.
Mm.
And maybe we'll respond, but probably not. Okay. Well, that was it. That's it for the year. That's our last podcast of 2023.
Yeah. Happy holidays.
Yes. Happy holidays. Happy New Year. Thanks for listening this long. And we're excited to come back in the new year with some more episodes.
Some more ordinary topics.
Yeah.
Whatever that means.
We'll think of it. Feel free to send us topics if you have anything. We've got a nice little list going of some fun things to talk about coming up. Cool. Okay. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next year.
Bye.